Over these next days, I'm going to talk to you quite a lot about the mind, because it's very obvious to you that to a really great extent, your life is directed, not just directed, but illuminated by what you perceive, by the ways in which you are making sense of the world. And much of this comes from the conditioning that you've received. What you've been told is possible, legitimate, impossible, or to be discarded. Yeah? So each of us comes in with, I think, great freshness of mind and great capacity to love and be loved and to be joyful and to be in the moment and so on. And then we are conditioned according to the circumstances of our birth, the place, the gender, the social class, the prevailing certainties, the prevailing disdains, the religion or culture that we're born into. And then, as we go through life and mature, if we are fortunate, and everyone here is fortunate, we get chances to question those things and to ask ourselves very deeply and very honestly, does that feel true? Does that feel true? And in a very real way, we have to grow out of the teachings of our forebears in order to come to those teachings freshly, if they are of use to us, and respectfully but moving on if they are not. And when I say forebears, I mean your immediate family who were conditioned by their time and place, but I also mean the social conditioning of your forebears. And I think that's particularly true in 21st century life, because from about the middle of last century, in those years of idealism that followed the catastrophe of there being a Second World War, and then we moved into the astonishing, radicalizing social movements that were called the movements of the 60s, but really were more the movements from the late 60s and through into the 70s. The civil rights movement, the peace movement, the ecological movement, the women's movement, which confronted in the most fundamental ways the certainties upon which life was supposed to be founded. What we discovered was that a lot of what we were told was truth was actually a matter of opinion that privileged some at the great expense of others. And all of that went up into a great volcano. And some of what came down was very, very positive. Most of those changes were profoundly needed, and it needed a volcano to make them. And some of those changes have been very partial, because, of course, within human nature, there are also very fearful, conserving, and even destructive qualities in all of us, in some more than in others. So in response to this apparent freeing up of the human family, there was also a rush, both politically and in terms of religion, in ways that we would not have predicted towards versions of certainty that are themselves profoundly divisive and harmful. So we see in this the old battle between Thanatos and Eros, between death and life forces that the Greeks themselves understood, and all the world that was affected by the Greek and Roman mythologies. And actually, if I think about it, in the Eastern world, if we think about the gods of destruction as well as the gods of creation, so some of what we regard as essential liberties to become fully human have been regarded by others as something to destroy. So we're actually at a very We're at a point in our shared history that I don't think any of us would have predicted. And I think that what it is calling from us is a tremendously honest understanding of what the mind is doing in creating a world outside ourselves to which we are responding. I hope that makes sense. I want it to make sense because it absolutely informs all that we're going to be talking about. So let me just give you one tiny example. The liberation movements that I was talking about were far from perfect. You know, I know that from the inside out. They were far from perfect. We were a subject to factionalism and, you know, thinking our version was more perfect than the other versions. We were as subject to that as anybody else within the women's movement, within the peace movement. These are human traits. But we also attempted, I think, to understand them. Same in the civil rights movement. You know, we have a capacity as a human family to factionalize, to divide ourselves against ourselves. Why? Because we have a capacity within ourselves to divide ourselves against ourselves. Yeah? So why wouldn't we project it outwards? Yeah? So when we talk about liberation movements, we need to think really clearly. What are we liberating ourselves from? We are liberating ourselves from constructions of the mind that limit us. However, many people believe that those constructions of the mind are not just true, but are God's truths, or are so familiar that they are self-evident and natural and therefore called, what, conservative values, family values, the right way to do things.
True.
True. Thank you. True.
True.
Yeah. Yes. So we all have tendencies in all of those directions. If we have more of a tendency towards liberating the human spirit to be all that it can be and not divided from itself, then we are incredibly fortunate. We are incredibly fortunate. But that doesn't mean that it is an easy path. The constructions of mind get in the way, and also the ego gets in the way, and also something that Karen Armstrong calls the tribal ego gets in the way. That is, we also fall into group thinking, don't we? Mm-hmm. We fall into group thinking. Now, Paul and I have both been reading Rabbi Jonathan Sacks lately, Paul even more than I. And one of his most recent books is called, Not in God's Name. Jonathan Sacks was the chief rabbi of Britain and is a profound intellectual and spiritual thinker of our time. And I think he writes more eloquently than any other contemporary writer about the dangers of tribal thinking. Tribal thinking is not embracing our individuality within the human family. It is setting one of us against the other, and we're all vulnerable to it because it feels like a cozier way of belonging. But unfortunately, it's very often predicated upon the otherness of the others. Mm-hmm. Our sameness depends on the otherness of the others. So, for example, when I was a child living in the Catholic world, we were Catholics and the others were nones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? This is not healthy, and no Catholic these days would talk about it in those ways. But within all the faiths, there are the faith group and the nones, which is why I'm not for one moment suggesting that we leave behind our affiliations of faith or particular family or particular grouping. I'm not. But I'm also asking us to think about perhaps whether our compassion and wisdom is in any way privileged to a specific group. Yeah? We all have our preferences. We really do. I do, you do, I know you do. We have our preferences. Of course we do. That's our very nature. But the big question for this time, if we are taking the notion of spiritual liberation at all seriously, is where does our compassion extend? To where does our vision of the human family extend? How willing are we to encompass the 12 gates to the city? The divine Jerusalem. 3 gates to the north, 3 gates to the south, 3 gates to the east, 3 gates to the west, 12 gates to the city to walk in Jerusalem just like John. How was John walking in Jerusalem? With all, loving all, however resistant to that we feel. I want to read you this little passage from John O'Donohue, and it's particularly poignant. It's particularly poignant for two reasons. One is that the violence we're capable of doing outside ourselves mirrors the violence we are capable of doing inside our own minds. My world for my entire adult life has been filled with very good people whose intentions are entirely honourable and who are also capable of speaking profoundly disrespectfully and discouragingly and even violently to themselves. In other words, putting themselves down, criticising themselves, picking at themselves, setting themselves up against an idealised version with which they can only fail, or conversely, keeping themselves limited out of fear. Avoiding self-knowledge of wrongdoing out of fear. Yeah? So, and that's also a kind of violence. So in thinking about compassion towards the world and compassion towards ourselves, I think we need to take heed of those words of the Epistle of James. Listen, not just to others, but also to how you speak to yourself. Are you speaking to yourself as you would to a beloved friend? Are you making excuses to yourself that, frankly, you've grown out of? Yeah? That doesn't mean harshness needs to come in. On the contrary, there's too much harshness in this world. Gentle, inspirational encouragement can be generated by the very same mind that generates discouragement. That is the wonder of the human mind. That the very same mind that generates destruction is what generates creation. The mind of God is the creative mind. But within that mind exists a terrifying capacity for destruction. I'm not saying within the mind of God. I know nothing about that. But I'm saying within our minds is a tremendous capacity for destruction. We need to attend to that. As the Greeks would say, the force of Thanatos coming against the force of Eros. The force of Eros, the erotic impulse, is not just a passion for one person, it's a passion for life. It's a yes to life. Now, John O'Donohue is one of the great poets of our time, and by poet in this instance I mean one of the great explainers of the human existence, because like Rilke or like Mary Oliver, there are aspects of our existence that can only be perceived through music or poetry. Katrina and I had a conversation about this just weeks ago, that Katrina recorded for her work at Melbourne Uni, and so it's available, where we were talking about music as the sphere of spirit, and poetry, of course, also. And it was so wonderful, wasn't it, to have that conversation, Katrina? Yeah, so if you want to listen in, Katrina will tell you how. But there are some things. This is why literalism is such an insult to the soul, because there are so many things that cannot be expressed literally. They can only be attended to and evoked through poetry. And the soul hears what is evoked, doesn't it? You know, that's why all the great teachers were poets. Jesus was the most poetic of teachers. If he was in the grave, he'd be turning with all this literalism. It's a total contradiction. But apparently he isn't. Not even the body. That's okay, it's fine. The Tibetan Buddhists do it too. It's called the rainbow body. The body disappears also. I love it when Christians laugh. I laugh too. The Christian in me laughs too. Okay, so John O'Donohue is one of the great poets of our time, and Paul and I sort of met over a copy of Divine Beauty, so, you know, and then we listened. Early on in our relationship, we listened to John O'Donohue reading Anamkara, which is one of the great ecstasies of this lifetime, to listen to John O'Donohue reading his book Anamkara, beloved soul. And anyway, he left the body very unexpectedly in 2008, just in his 50s, the boy. And he left behind this little outline of a talk that he was going to give, and it's so apposite, so perfect for our time here together. It's called The Art of Developing a Beautiful Mind. The world is not simply there. Everything and everyone we see, we view through the lenses of our thoughts. Don't write this down. I'll send it to you at some point. Just close your eyes and listen to John. Because each of us is saying this in another way and in the same way, reminding you of what you already know. Your mind is where your thoughts arise and form. Now, think of the mind now also as the body, and think of the soul not as some little something, but as you are not so much the soul in the body as the body in the soul. Your mind is where your thoughts arise and form. It is not simply with your eyes, but with your mind that you see the world. How true. So much depends on your mind, how you see yourself, who you think you are, how you see others, what you think the meaning of life is, how you see death, belief, God, darkness and beauty is all determined by the style of mind you have. And I want to interject there, so this is Stephanie speaking, and to say, everything changes. Everything changes when we recognize that all of life is sacred, that all of life is holy, that all of life is healing us, and that we are healing all of life. Everything changes. Yeah? That's what seeking the sacred really was testimony to. That's what our retreat is testimony to. That is what your presence here on this retreat is testimony to, that your life is sacred, that all of life is sacred, that all the parts that you would have left outside the door are sacred, are regenerating, are regenerative, that nothing needs to be left outside the door, that there is no door, that we are all door, that we are all inside, that we are all outside, that we are all. I don't want you to hear that. I want you to feel it, that we are all. That is our holiness, that we are all. Back to John. Your mind is your greatest treasure. We become so taken up with the world, with having and doing more and more, that we come to ignore who we are and forget what we see the world with. I'm interrupting again. We forget that the world we see the mind with is the conditioned mind. Yeah? And that spirituality allows us to question with great curiosity and engagement and passion and persistence what we are seeing and whether it makes sense. In other words, we become more conscious of what we are seeing. We wake up. That's the call. Yeah. That is the call to save ourselves. Amazing grace. I once was blind, but now I see. Amazing grace. And that's a transformation. It's not just a change, it's a transformation. And once transformed, you can't go back. You can pretend, but you don't go back. That's glorious, isn't it? It doesn't mean you won't fall. You'll fall 1,000 times, but you'll get up with even greater courage. Back to John. The most powerful way to change your life is to change your mind. Actually, to wake up your mind. To allow your mind to be open. Until it embraces all of who you are. I think that's what he was meaning. And if he wasn't just writing an outline and they'd said, John, you're only allowed 150 words, he would have said that to you. I know he would. Here it is. In this evening's talk, says John, we will explore ways of awakening, enriching and refining your mind, as indeed we will. We will use lecture. I'm not so sure that we'll use lecture, John. Conversation, yes, we will. Story, yes, we will. Poetry, yes, we will. And meditation, yes, we will. And we'll add song. Now, this is very beautiful. He tells us, he reminds us, he shows us, he demonstrates to us. When you beautify your mind, you beautify the world. You are not on retreat alone. You are not on retreat for yourself alone. Every jewel that you polish, you carry for the rest of us. Yeah? Every insight that you grow into, you polish for the rest of us. Every act of kindness that you receive and give, you do so for the rest of us. We cannot benefit one another without benefiting ourselves. We cannot benefit ourselves without benefiting one another. We're in this together. John says, in what seemed like dead situations. Oh, I like that. In what seemed like dead situations, there is always an arising. Because in the spiritual life, there is no death. That is what Jesus also taught us, that there is no death, there is always an arising. The body, of course, decays. The body, of course, has to be shed at some point. Yeah? And there is an arising. Invitations begin to open before you. Invitations, inspiration, instinct, imagination, integration, all those wonderful words that begin with I. Because the I has to receive them through the eyes of perception. I'll say them again. Inspiration, instinct, imagination.
Integration.
Thank you, Deborah.
Intuition.
Thank you, Judy. Instinct and intuition we have often learned through the conditioned mind not to trust so well, particularly those of us who are very expensively and with education with a lot of privilege. We've often been taught to repress our instincts, our imagination, our intuitions. So we have to reclaim them and bring them into the maturity that we have now. And poetry is very helpful with this. And so is music, and so is prayer, and so is dance, and so is nature. And so is the gospel of the face. Reading faces of everyone that you are with in order that you will respond more fruitfully. Oh, how lovely. This is for you, Dee. In old suffering that held you long paralyzed, you find new keys. And there always is a new key, because the key has to be fresh for today. When your mind awakens, your life comes alive, and the creative adventure of your soul takes off. And to think that he wrote this just on the eve of his soul taking off is our loss, but not his. Because what he left behind, of course, were the trails of glory that he came in with.
Definitely don't mind reading that last bit again.
I don't mind at all. When your mind awakens, your life comes alive, and the creative adventure of your soul takes off. Where's my folder here? I want to read you something else. Just in case you have any notion that the adventures of the soul should be solemn or pious, here's a beautiful teaching from Swami Vivekananda, who not incidentally brought the wisdom of the East, as it's called, it's actually the universal wisdom, to the very first Parliament of Religions. He was a follower of Ramakrishna. The very first Parliament of Religions in Chicago were transfixed by this man, Swami Vivekananda, bringing them a version of spirituality that they had had no access to through generations, that they had thought they had to bring an imperialism of religion to. Anyway, here's this lovely thing that he says, which wasn't part of his talk that day. The first sign of your becoming religious is that you're becoming cheerful. When someone is gloomy, his condition may be dyspepsia, but it's not religion. In other words, it could be indigestion. To the yogi, everything is bliss. Every human face that he sees brings cheerfulness to him. Why? Because he has learned from the Upanishads to see him or herself in others and others in him or herself, and knows through this he or she has nothing to fear. That is the central teaching of the Upanishads, and it is the central teaching of the Golden Rule in the Hindu tradition. See yourself in others and others in yourself. You will have nothing to fear. In other words, desist from making others of others. We take a long time. We do, don't we? That teaching is probably 3,000 years old. I'm going to read you at some point all the different golden rules. In every faith, Zoroastrian, every faith, the Tao Te Ching, all the most ancient. John, passion and compassion become your new companions. Don't you love it that he's putting the two together? Passion for life. When we have enough passion for living, compassion becomes very natural. When we have enough love for our own existence, compassion becomes very natural, and the moments at which we feel its absence, we can be forgiving and we can welcome it back. We can also sit for some moments or some days or even some weeks or months in the desert of our suffering. We don't have to hurry past it. We can bring patience to it. That is a profound expression of compassion. Yeah? Patience. We can be passionate also in our expression of patience, because sometimes we need to be in the desert in order to recover parts of ourselves that have been sent far into exile and have to be accompanied home so gently to the heart. Yes, I'll try to say it again. The place of the desert, we often want to rush past it. But sometimes we have exiled parts of ourselves to the desert, and we need to sit there very patiently in order to bring them home, holding their hand very kindly, acknowledging their fears, acknowledging even what those fears have saved us from, and then bringing them home to the heart in their time. Not the time of ought to, should, must, in their time. That's also compassion. Compassion is not just about being ever cheerful. Yeah. It's also about being deeply, deeply consoling. And knowing that will pass. The desert is not all we are. Hilary and I were speaking yesterday about the journey of Christ towards his death and the suffering and the necessity to withdraw to the desert in order to meet not just his own fears, which were very great and which were present to the very end, and how much he taught us in that we should not be banishing at those fears, but we need to meet them and also to meet the temptations that are ascribed to the devil, but are really the temptations of the less conscious mind, that we could avoid suffering. Yeah. Or that we could avoid a premature death. There is so much teaching in that. And that is also part of the compassionate mind that the Buddha was talking about. North, south, east, and west are not just geographical directions. They are also directions of all the landscapes of the mind. They are directions of all the seasons of the mind. We are not in constant blossom. We are sometimes quiet. We are sometimes exuberant. We are experiencing that also on retreat. We are sometimes outraged, and sometimes we are outrageous. Mm-hmm. So the 12 gates to the city, the four directions, these are also metaphors for the spaciousness of the mind and for the seasons of the soul. Sometimes great patience is needed. Sometimes you would like to be in a different place from where you are. You might like to have got on the train that wasn't just called wisdom or compassion, but enlightenment. Although some of you might want to say, not yet. There is also a request on us that arises from honesty and truthfulness to see ourselves where we are, to work with what we have right now, not with the hypothesis, but with where we are right now. And the very obliging thing about life is that it tends to bring us, I mean, it brings us such a lot that there's always something, isn't there? Well, at least there is in mine. I'm sure there is in yours. Not just the difficulties, please. Also the joys, the moments of beautiful connection, the moment when we extended ourselves and found how easy that was, or the moment we extended ourselves and found that was mighty hard, but so worth it. Yeah. So John O'Donohue finishes with this. As Saint Irenaeus said in the 2nd century, the glory of God is the human person fully alive. Would you just write in your notebook, I affirm my power to be fully alive. I affirm my power to be fully alive. I affirm my power to be fully alive.